Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, Congressman Michael Grimm used to think that global warming and the FBI investigation into his financial dealings were both government hoaxes. Now he has changed on one of those. The latest on the congressman from New York City being indicted this morning in just a minute. Also today, who cares if the New York City suburbs shrivel up and die? Not the kids who grew up there, apparently. We will look at a new Regional Plan Association report on the decline of the suburbs in greater New York, and we will ask our suburban callers, seriously, if you care. Plus, gluten-free living, according to actress Jennifer Esposito, who lost her role on Blue Bloods because of celiac, and your reactions to the Donald Sterling tape. And what should L.A. Clippers fans and Clippers players and the rest of America do to protest if the team owner really made those crude racist remarks? We will invite you to get creative on Donald Sterling. But let's get to our Monday morning politics headline. Leading nationally as well as locally right now, New York City Congressman Michael Grimm surrendering to federal authorities this morning on a criminal indictment, a collection of them actually, about to be unveiled. Coincidentally, on the morning after a Showtime documentary featured his post-Sandy change of heart on global warming. We will talk now to MSNBC host Chris Hayes, who was involved in that Showtime piece. And you may know MSNBC's Chris Hayes for hosting their weeknight 8 p.m. show, All In with Chris Hayes. And he contributed to this much-discussed new Showtime documentary on global warming called Years of Living Dangerously. And here he is in our studio. He works mornings. He works nights. Hi, Chris Hayes. Welcome back to WNYC.
It is great to be back here.
And are you the unluckiest reporter in America today?
Someone texted me last night and said, well, you know, got a Republican convert on climate change. Too bad he got indicted the next day.
The night the piece airs on Showtime, if you flip over to CNN, it's all, oh, Michael Grimm is going to surrender to federal agents tomorrow for the way he ran his business. You got pretty unlucky here. How much, and we'll get to the details of the Grimm indictment, but how much does this arrest blow the Michael Grimm seize the light on climate change story that you reported?
Well, you know, in some ways, not that much for this reason. The story is less about Michael Grimm, the individual, than about the politics of climate change writ large. And Grimm is an example of someone who is just amazingly honest in the interview that we were able to do with him for the series about what the politics are. That, to me, is more important than an individual member of Congress in among 435 members of Congress.
So here is a clip from Years of Living Dangerously. This is you and Congressman Grimm, who, by the way, you followed for like a year on this issue, didn't
you? Yeah, I spent a fair amount of time with him. And I have to say, notwithstanding our obvious political differences and notwithstanding the fact the man was indicted today, he and his staff were uncommonly accessible and open and honest throughout this whole thing in a way that is extremely rare for politicians.
40 seconds, Congressman Grimm and Chris Hayes. Grimm speaks first.
The vast majority of respected scientists say, you know, that it's conclusive. The evidence is clear. So I don't think the jury is out.
The basic story of we're putting carbon in the atmosphere, the planet's getting warmer, that's going to make the sea levels rise. Like, the basic story of that you pretty much agree with, right?
Sure. I mean, there's no question that, you know, the oceans have risen, right? And the climate change part is a real part of it. The problem that we're going to have right now, there's no oxygen left in the room in Washington right now for another big debate. That's the reality. You know, between immigration and tax reform.
I don't disagree, but let me ask you.
It's just not going to take front stage.
Congressman Michael Grimm on Years of Living Dangerously, the global warming documentary on Showtime with MSNBC's Chris Hayes, who contributed and who is here in our studio. So how do you account for his change of heart? Is it just that Sandy hitting his district made him sit up and say, holy crap, this is really happening, or something that's more of a political calculation, or what?
I think it's a confluence of things. I think seeing firsthand what happened in Sandy, I think the intervention of former Congressman Bob Inglis, who is a conservative Republican from South Carolina, who is probably the most prominent conservative advocate of taxing carbon or doing something about carbon pollution. He has a sit down with Michael Grimm in the documentary. And I think him – sometimes, you know, if someone came to me and wanted to convert me on something and they were a conservative or right-wing or a Republican, I'm going to kind of get my back up. I think having Inglis go to him and talk to him really helped. And I also think Michael Grimm is an interesting case because he is a very rare breed. He is one of – and I think I get the numbers right – 17 members of the House Republican Caucus in districts won by Barack Obama. It's a very small number. And he is one of them. And so there's been a variety of issues, immigration, a few other things, where he's been targeted because he's got a constituency that they're conservative and he won his election, you know, handily. But they voted for Barack Obama in 2012. He's got a constituency that he has to worry about. And I think that probably plays a part as well from a political standpoint.
Right. Another way that New York City is unusual, and I guess for folks who know the culture, the politics of Staten Island and that part of Brooklyn across the bridge that's also in his district. Yeah, it's an area that may well have voted for Barack Obama but may well send a Republican to Congress.
Absolutely.
But there are many of those around the United States.
No, and in fact, that's one of the defining structural features of American politics in this moment is how vanishingly small those kinds of members of Congress are increasingly, particularly in the Republican caucus.
So, listeners, anything you want to say about Michael Grimm being indicted this morning? We'll get to more of the details of that. Anybody see Years of Living Dangerously, the episode that ran last night? Anybody watch Chris Hayes All In on MSNBC and want to ask him anything? 212-433-WNYC. And we'll get into a little other politics. 212-433-9692 to talk to Chris Hayes today, or if you read him in The Nation, 212-433-9692. So in that context of Michael Grimm's unusual place in, you know, the Republican congressional political world, most analysts say the House and the Senate are likely to go more Republican, not less, in the midterm elections this fall, even though the Republican Congress has like the lowest poll numbers in the history of poll numbers, like a 5% approval rating. So as a liberal host on a liberal network, how do you understand that likelihood over there at MSNBC? Why is this true?
There's a few factors. One is the nature of the political coalitions, the combination of gerrymandering and the redistricting that happened post 2010, in which Republicans took a lot of state houses, gave them a bit of a built-in advantage in the House. There is also the fact that there was a lot of retirements on the Senate side. And just the way the cycle works, there's a lot of red state Democrats who happen to be up now. You combine all that with the fact that we basically have two different electorates in this country. We have a presidential electorate and a midterm electorate, and they look quite different from each other. The midterm electorate is older, whiter, and more conservative than the presidential electorate. And what we have had is this kind of oscillating Democratic enterprise in which in 2008 the presidential electorate showed up and they elected a certain group of people. In 2010, the midterm electorate showed up and they elected a very different group of people. Mm-hmm. And we have divided government in which these two electorates are kind of at war with each other.
Democrats, I mean, yeah, all of what you say is true. And yet the House flipped to the Democrats in 2006.
Yes.
That was when George Bush was falling so out of favor in the middle of his last term. The Republicans took back the House in 2010, as you say. So change of power happens.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's certainly not impossible. I think the other thing I would say is that one of the defining features of the American electorate, American politics, since the Great Crash, is the fact that the recovery is bad. For most people, it's not good. We have high unemployment. We have stagnating or declining real per household income. And most elections fundamentally are a kind of Siskel and Ebert enterprise in which people show up and they say, thumbs up, things going all right, thumbs down, things not going so well. And we have had a succession of you know, expressions of discontent because the majority of people haven't seen a raise in 6 or 7 years. I mean, that is the underlying truth about American politics. All the stuff on top of that is driven by that core fundamental fact that in a deep systemic structural way, the American economy is broken and not working for most people.
And if we have time, as the segment goes on, I saw your interview with Piketty, who wrote Capital.
Yep.
On MSNBC, and that book has started such a big debate about where we turn to do something about most of America not getting a raise while the 1%, quote unquote, is getting lots of big raises. And we'll come back to that if we have time. So listeners, on that or anything else you want to ask Chris Hayes from MSNBC about, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. We will get to Chris's article in The Nation calling for a new abolition movement, the abolition of fossil fuels. But Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Brian. I did watch the Years of Living Dangerously episodes, including last night's, and I thought it was very effective. And I question whether it really should have any effect on the credibility of what Mr. Grimm said about climate, since whatever he's being indicted for doesn't have anything to do with the subject matter of his climate discussion. If anything, someone who had been on the other side of the issue would seem to have more credibility with people who are also climate deniers than somebody who's always been part of the choir.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And I would also say we don't know a ton about – we should talk about the indictment. We don't know a ton about what it is. But I will say this. Michael Grimm has had a series of investigations around people around him for quite some time. The irony being he used to be in the FBI. The FBI has been investigating him. And they have – I think there's two indictments of donors for essentially straw donations. As far as has been reported, the current indictment doesn't touch on any of that. It touches on his business dealings at a health food store he opened up before he ran for Congress. So,
how about that?
And I don't know. I know nothing about whether it's a legit indictment or not, whether he's guilty of the crime. All I know is that as far as I can tell from what's been reported, it doesn't even touch any kind of official malfeasance about what he did in his runs for office, member of Congress, et cetera.
That's my understanding. And the indictment is expected to be officially unsealed at 11 o'clock, though he's already in custody. So we'll find out more then. And we will continue to cover this as the breaking news story of the morning of both political and national interest once we get those details at 11 o'clock. So you can stay with us for that. But it is interesting because there's been all this buzz about the investigation into his campaign finances that would be malfeasance having to do with being in office. And all of a sudden, reportedly, there's this multiple count indictment having to do with health food. So I don't know if he was selling gluten-free crackers that actually contain wheat or what the charge is here, but I guess we'll find out. Let's see. All right. Let's go to another climate-related. Well, here's Bob in Rego Park. Bob, you're on WNYC with Chris Hayes. Hi.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, guy? Chris, I used to watch you on Saturday and Sunday. It was a great show, 2 hours. I continue to watch Saturday and Sunday. Quite frankly, I don't watch you at night because you only have an hour. You don't have time to get in-depth. Will you in the future maybe change your show at night to 2 hours?
So should he kick off?
It's very frustrating.
Should he kick off Chris Matthews, who comes before him, or Rachel Maddow, who comes after him?
No, you know what, Bob, I appreciate the feedback because I do think that what we were able to do on the weekends was distinct, particularly for cable news, the depth it allowed us. The fact of the matter is, you know, formats come with their own confines, and you know, you just can't go as far in depth at a 1 o'clock, 1 hour show every night as you can 2 hours on the weekend. We had the whole week to prepare. We were kind of off the radar. There's also this. You know, television is a fascinating thing where you're fighting for the audience's attention all the time. And under the conditions of a primetime show at 8 p.m., you know, people are sitting down in front of the TV to watch television. And the sword fight for those eyeballs is far more intense. People watch the weekend show, I think, in a way that's similar to people right now are listening to our voices on WNYC. You put it on, you go make coffee, you come back in the room, and it allows a kind of breath it allows things to breathe in a way that is very difficult to replicate under the conditions of primetime hour television.
And your Saturday hours, which were 8 to 10, and Sunday hours. I mean, it's so sleepy. Weekend Today and shows like that right. are so sleepy.
Yes. No, there was not a lot. There's not a lot we were up against. And also people's – the other thing I've learned is that people's brains are much more open and clear Saturday and Sunday morning and more in a posture to kind of – synthesize and chew through information than they necessarily are after having worked all day, being home at night.
Right. And so when you're in your production meetings for the weeknight show, is there this sense that, hey, we're not only up against Papa Bear, Bill O'Reilly on Fox News at the time, but you're also up against, you know, every comedy and drama on every network and primetime television.
The thing I think about all the time is we're up against playoff basketball. I mean, if I were home, if I weren't me and I were home and I'm a politics junkie, I would watch playoff basketball. I mean,
who's your team? I don't know where you're from.
I was born and raised in the Bronx. My father is from Chicago. And so even though I was born and raised in the Bronx, even though I was born a few miles from Yankee Stadium, I was raised a Cubs, Bulls, and Bears fan.
So do you want to weigh in, which is going to be an early segue to our next segment, on the Donald Sterling, owner of the Clippers, remarks? You know, one of the things we're going to ask people to do, if assuming that the tape is authenticated and he really did tell his girlfriend or mistress or whatever she was, you know, not to hang around with Magic Johnson and other black people, what? Get creative here. What's the proper protest?
Well, I think that puts the finger on the fact that it's hard to figure out what exactly the accountability will be, seeing as how he owns the team, and were he forced to sell it, would pocket quite a profit on the team.
Huh.
I thought their sort of silent protest, in which they threw their jerseys in the middle, they warmed up with the shirts turned inside out. I thought that was pretty effective. I think that
some people thought that was pretty thin.
Yeah. You know, look, it's funny. Everybody's got someone that signs their paycheck. And that's a profound truth about this world. And it's very easy to tell someone else who's got someone who signs their paycheck to stick it to their boss. And it takes real courage and it's very difficult to do. And so I err on the side in any environment of not casting judgment on folks for not, you know, being more outspoken towards their boss. That's sort of my general feeling about
it. That's a good compassionate attitude toward the employees of the world. Yeah. Listeners, we'll get into this in our next segment. You can tweet us now at Brian Lehrer and get creative. What would you do to protest Donald Sterling if he actually made those remarks on the tape that purports to be his voice? But for Chris Hayes from MSNBC, Sarah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have just a quick question about corporations' posture towards this whole issue. I watch the news and listen to your show and all as much as I can, and sometimes I hear that corporations are actually shifting their stance from climate change deniers to climate change, I don't know what the word is, but advocates, in the sense that they're finally understanding that their profits and their world is going to be impacted by this whole conversation, and essentially their ability to gather the resources they need to do their business. Is there hope on that front?
There is. There are certain industries that are way ahead on this. One industry is the reinsurance industry, which is the industry that insures insurers for big catastrophic risks. And you won't be surprised to learn that they are quite worried about the effects of climate. It will affect their bottom line. And I think some of those concerns have begun to cascade out through corporate America. Even Exxon, okay, who have through various back channels funded all kinds of denial. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of Exxon, says climate change, carbon emissions are causing climate change. In fact, in Steve Call's fantastic book about Exxon, there's a part about how their scientists are looking at how they can get more oil out of the Arctic as the Arctic ice melts,
huh,
thanks to climate change.
So, oh, look, it's easier to get down there now.
Exactly. So you have – I think the strain of denialism is weaker in corporate America than it is in, say, frankly, the Republican Party or the American conservative movement. Now, the question becomes, what do they do about it? And that's a whole different – set of questions. But in terms of just raw denialism, it is much less prevalent amongst you know, Fortune 500 companies than the House Republican caucus.
Sarah, thank you. And I was going to begin my answer to her in the exact same way that you did. The insurance company, the insurance industry is so interesting on this because in a way, they're the most objective actors. I mean, if you don't believe, you know, politicians who think we have to do something about global warming, if you don't even believe the International Panel on Climate Change and you think that 97% of the world's climate scientists have some kind of ideological bias here or have been backed into a corner because of the deniers and so they're more chicken little than they have to be, the insurance companies are the ones with the green shade accountants looking at the bottom line of what kind of damage is going to happen to the companies that they insure and the individuals that they insure because of sea level rise and because of all these potential effects and effects actually happening that look no further than the insurance bottom line for pretty, you know, steely-eyed take on what the situation is.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think was communicated in the years of Living Dangerously on Showtime last night, which folks can watch all week, by the way, on demand. It's playing all week. It'll be played a bunch of times. When you get into the world of the effects of climate, you're dealing with these seemingly small numbers that have huge effects. So one example is there was about an extra foot of sea level rise before the storm surge and the high tide came when Sandy happened, right? And that was almost entirely due to climate change, okay? Well, a foot doesn't sound like much. There's one study that says a foot's about 75,000 extra homes that took water because of that foot of sea level rise. And so when you're talking about climate, you're talking about these things like a 2-degree raise of you know global temperature averages.
Yes,
right.
That was another one I was going to bring that up, and I think you referenced that in your Nation article. You hear 2.5 degrees Celsius rise, maybe 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Rise in temperature over the next 100 years, you know, okay, well, it's going to be hot, you know. But then you hear what people say, like, this is the end of humanity as we know it after 2.5 degrees Celsius,
right.
And you scratch your head.
Exactly. And there is a mismatch between that. Two things I'd say on that. One is if we continue business as usual, by the end of this century, Fargo, North Dakota is going to be about as hot as Phoenix. Okay?
What?
So that, yes, business right now – current trajectory of both carbon, if we don't do anything.
That's impossible.
It is not impossible.
That's impossible. It's certainly not 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
No, so we're talking about global averages are 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And the other thing is, if we continue business as usual, we are going to blow way past 5 degrees Fahrenheit. We've already warmed the planet 0.8 degrees Celsius. We got 1.2 Celsius left, and that's if we curtail emissions drastically by mid-century. If we keep doing what we're all collectively doing on this planet, we will get to the point where Fargo is Phoenix. Fargo as Phoenix, I think, makes people realize what we're talking about when you hear the Chicken Little kind of stuff. The second thing I would say is when you think about temperature rise, I have a newborn son. He's 4 weeks old.
Congratulations.
It's awesome.
So you work day and night and you're awake day and night.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, last weekend he's 3 weeks old and he had a fever. And, you know, fevers with infants are they're scary things. Right? We had to go to the ER and we're sitting there with a thermometer and you're checking, you know, is he up half a degree Fahrenheit, a degree Fahrenheit, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, right? The human body is an amazingly robust little system. You jack up the temperature on a human body just 2 or 3 degrees, you're looking at something that's actually pretty threatening. So that's the way to think about what we're talking about. You've got a system that's set at a certain equilibrium. You raise it 2-3 degrees. Think about a human body that goes up 3-4 degrees. You're running a 102, 103 fever. That is no joke.
Chris Hayes on his infant as an analogy for climate change. When the baby has a fever, he is genuinely all in. Chris Hayes, host of All In on MSNBC. And in The Nation, you called for a new abolitionist movement, for the abolition of fossil fuels. And you don't use the word abolition lightly. You actually compare what would be necessary in economic terms to the abolition of slavery, and not in moral terms, and you make that very clear. You know, slavery is, you know, in a category up there by itself.
Yep.
With the Holocaust and things like that. But in economic terms, what are you talking about?
So the total value of the slaves in the South on the eve of the Civil War, it's hard to get a precise number, but it was in the ballpark of about $10 trillion in current wealth. It was more than all the railroads and banks in the country put together. It was more than half of wealth in the South on the eve of the Civil War. It was 16% of the total wealth in the country, okay? And from one day to the next, that wealth was zeroed out. It was a massive, it was a massive liberatory moment of freeing people from bondage. And we think about it now in those terms, as we should, because it is perverse and disgusting to think about human beings as property. But it was also a huge expropriation. It was probably the largest expropriation in American history. So when you look at what has to happen globally in terms of climate, we already have about five times as much of carbon fossil fuels in the ground tabulated on known reserves than we can put into the atmosphere by mid-century and stay at that 2-degree mark, which means 80% of it's got to stay in the ground. That represents trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of wealth that has to be zeroed out.
But why go all the way to abolition compared to the more usual activist position like Al Gore supporting a carbon tax to incentivize transition or a cap and trade system to at least stop the growth of carbon emissions and then let the market work it out? It also doesn't take into account adaptation, which the IPCC is more into than ever before.
Sure.
That is all the things to make us, you know, be able to yep. live in a warmer world. So why go that far if some of the those other things might do it, and if renewables realistically aren't ready to pick up the slack on a real scalable basis?
Well, I actually think those two things aren't in tension. The point is that what we are actually trying to get to is the ultimate abolition. I mean, when I say we got to leave 80% in the ground, the 20% that we're going to take out, that's a lot of fossil fuels. I think people don't quite realize how much is out there, right? We're going to keep flying and driving and all this stuff. What we have to get to relatively quickly is a system in which, you know, we are able to power industrial modern life without reliance on fossil fuels.
We will have to do Piketty another time because our time has flown, as we've spoken about Michael Grimm. We've spoken about global warming. We've spoken about midterms. We've spoken about competing at 8 o'clock at night on MSNBC and network television land. Just give us one more word on years of living dangerously. I mean, obviously, it's a series about global warming. What's really new here? What's the big contribution?
The newest thing is that we right now live on the front edge of the change. If for so long, it's been about the stuff in the future. And what this series does is it illustrates in real terms who really is on the front lines of this. People in the Rockaways without power, people suffering through droughts in Texas, the firefighters out west who are fighting more fires than they've ever fought before. It is happening now to actual people, all of us. And what this series does more than anything I've ever seen is illustrate the fact that it is here now.
On demand all this week on Showtime. Watch anytime except 8 o'clock on the weeknights when Chris Hayes hosts.
Thank you, Brian.
All In on MSNBC or, of course, 10 to 12 on the weekday mornings. Chris Hayes, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, what to do about Donald Sterling, the owner of the LA Clippers basketball team, allegedly caught on tape, and we'll play the tape, making racist comments. We'll see what his team did on the court last night, and we will invite you to get creative as we unpack that story. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.